What if you could get the benefits of fasting without starving yourself? Prolon's five-day program leverages nutrition technology to develop actual food that mimics the effects of fasting. It's clinically proven to trigger a fasting state while you eat. That's why Prolon is not a diet. Prolon is the future of nutrition. Prolon is offering listeners 15% off site-wide, plus a $40 bonus gift when you subscribe to their five-day program. Just visit ProlonLife.com. That's ProlonLife.com.
The new McCrispy Strip is here. Dip approved by ketchup, tangy barbecue, honey mustard, Sprite, McFlurry, Big Mac sauce, double dipped in buffalo and ranch, more ranch, and creamy chili McCrispy Strip Dip. Now at McDonald's. Ba-da-ba-ba-ba.
Alive and Kicking with Claire McKenna on News Talk.
Yes, you can email the show aliveandkicking@newstalk.com or you will find me on Instagram. I'm at Claire McKenna Presents. Coming up this morning, Dr. Conor Curley on the personal diagnosis in his teens, which led to him studying the power of nutrition. Niall McHugo on overcoming career stress and burnout, and Olympian Nadia Power on leading Wellfest's first ever run club. So what kind of a health and wellness week did I have? Well, it's been a busy week. I came back to the working world with a bang. I led a breathwork session to a group of fund managers on Monday. Now, I don't want you to think I've lost the run of myself and got some sort of God complex, but it does really feel like you are giving a gift to busy people when you're giving them the opportunity to be still, slow down their breathing and hopefully reduce their stress levels. And I do always at these events give lots of ideas on how people can bring it into their everyday lives, because even three deep breaths with a focus on a long, slow exhale can relax the central nervous system. So it's brilliant for any big transitions, like before a meeting or a presentation, maybe in the car before you go into work or at the end of the day before you go into your house. And I was also speaking this week at the Keep Well Awards with IBEC, and it's great to see workplace wellbeing just becoming the norm and to watch companies being awarded for thriving in this area. Because I was at the Reinvention Summit this week where I learned about quiet quitting, staying employed but disengaged. And research shows that 59% of employees fall into this category. And I think it's fair to say the working world is changing at such an alarming rate, and reinvention is needed more now than ever, which is a tricky task when burnout is also at an all-time high. So keeping well-being at the centre for every workplace means more engagement, more loyalty, more productivity and a stronger workforce to navigate such change. You can email the show aliveandkicking@newstalk.com. So let's hear a story now about overcoming career burnout. Niall McHugo was working as a teaching principal and his work-life balance was fairly non-existent and stress was at an all-time high. And Niall joins me in studio now. Niall, you're very welcome.
Thank you for having me. It's great to be here.
So looking at your story, you're not afraid to take a jump, to listen in life when things need a change.
Yeah, it was the travel bug. I think there was, everybody was going away. Australia was calling. And I was sort of ready to do it. I was playing football, but I knew if I didn't go then or take a break. And it's the biggest thing. It's really hard to do is to take that jump because your money's coming in and, you know, you have a nice quality of life. And then you know you're going to have no income. So it's like you just have to bite the bullet and say, this is for me. I'm going to take a leap and, yeah, ask for a career break. It wasn't a thing they did at the time, but I was lucky enough to get accepted for a year. And, yeah, booked my tickets. And that Christmas I was off to Asia to do a bit of travelling and just travelled. But it was the leap, yeah. I think it's the hardest thing to do. And then I knew when I took that break, it was easier to make a decision on a career path because I wasn't in it. You know, I wasn't going there. Because when you're in a job 9 to 5 and you're working, you know, it's so hard to get. So a career break was the best thing, I think, for me. So it gave me that year and a half, actually, because then on the 12 months was coming up, my manager emailed me saying, you know, you're 12 months, what are you doing? And I think I was in New Zealand. So I was like, you know, I just resigned. So that led me into teaching then, because I had to, you know, I came back from New Zealand and had my year and a bit out. And did a bit of sub-teaching. I was offered a few days in a school and loved it, even though it was in junior infants, which was crazy. But I just loved the connection, loved the outcome every day. It was just to seeing, yeah, trying to help people. I think that was my calling, to help people. I think that was why what I do now really, it, you know, is even more so. It's more, you know, even more helpful to every age group. So
yeah, and sometimes when you look back at the threads in your life, and then obviously on your travels, and again then in the classroom. So
yeah,
I think it's an important lesson that you're giving people. I mean, not everybody can down tools and head off travelling, but even to take some time out in your week, in your month, in your year to say, where am I? Am I happy? What's working? What isn't?
Yeah.
So this teaching was something that you were open to, that came to you. You went back and retrained, and you began working, and a principal role came up, and you went for it. But that was quite a lot to take on, to be teaching and running a school.
It was. It came quite soon. Like, I just qualified, went into a lovely school, and then a job came up quite quickly. A principal job came up. And yeah, I was asked to go for it. I think when you're asked to go for it in a school, it means you're going for it. It's yours, you know, like, unless obviously an external person comes in, but I was sort of chosen to say, you do it. And a bit shocked, because I was only there, you know, permanent a year, and I had been in and out of the school doing the supply teaching for a few years, so I knew the staff. But I went in, I loved it. I have to say, I absolutely loved the, yeah, I suppose I had the administration skills from my advertising days, so I was quite organised, and, you know, and I could structure my day and a busy day. But it was slowly, yeah, I just realised it was doing two jobs. I suppose it was the differentiation between the leadership side of it and the teaching side of it as a teaching principal, because every day I had to lead the school. And one thing that I prioritised was the well-being of the children, the staff, and making everybody happy. But unfortunately, what happens is nobody's there to make you happy. You're on your own. It's quite isolating, because you've nobody above you, nobody sort of beside you to lead, especially in a small school. You know, in bigger schools in the city in Dublin, you might have a walking principal and a walking deputy principal. So you can work hand in hand, you know, and you're both organising the day. But when you're a teaching principal, you're teaching all day. And then at 3 o'clock, your office day starts, and the constant distractions and interruptions, because a lot of people don't know you're actually teaching. The reps don't know. Some parents might know, if you're not teaching their children, they just think principals are in the office all day. So it was a hard job. I felt like you're trying to do two jobs, and you're being pulled both ways. And I loved teaching. I had fifth and sixth class for years, and I loved the connection with them, because they're getting to that age, and they're you know, the maturity starts to kick in, you know, and they are, and you can talk to them as adults, and you can try loads of things out. And we used to, you know, do loads of extra activities, you know, loads of junior entrepreneur program, and, you know, we got loads of external teachers in music, you know, got violins in. And but there's a lot of work to do that, to get a school like that. And everybody said when they walked in the door, they could feel the energy. The energy was amazing. They just said, what, like, the school is like, and there mightn't be anyone, you know, children there. They just felt the energy of the school. So that meant a lot, because that was what my aim was, to make everyone happy. And you could see it. The children were happy. I think the staff are happy. But unfortunately, you sort of put on that mask every day, and sometimes you're not fully, you're burying yourself in your work. Because external things come up too, I suppose, personal things in your life, where I felt I probably did bury myself in the job a lot to try and probably numb thinking about other things, you know. So yeah, I can be partly to blame for burnout, which unfortunately happened.
Yeah, and I mean, you had your own family as well, so you're trying to juggle that, as many people are. And I think a lot of people will relate to this. You have a job you love, it's fulfilling, it's working, but it's taking up a massive amount of your time. Yeah. And then you're trying to get home to the home responsibility. So you just start to slip lower and lower down the priorities list. And eventually what starts as a whisper becomes a shout, becomes a scream. Tell me about feeling burnt out and what that felt like and looked like.
I think the first step, I always said, if you wake up in the morning and it's a struggle to go to work, that thing that just hits you, going, you know, this is, I don't want to go. I used to jump out, you know, getting my routine, and love getting into school, meeting the kids and having it, you know, and just, you know, getting stuck in. But I think when you get to that point of just, oh, you know, you're taking, like, here we go again. And you feel you're trying to, you're chasing your tail, really, because you're actually just, you have such a long list. I wouldn't be good delegator, and that was a problem. You know, I suppose if I had a list of jobs, my personal way was it'd be easier to do it yourself than explain how to do it because I'd have it done.
I think people will be listening and thinking, yeah, well, that's me. I'm working really hard. I kind of drag myself out of bed, but I have a family. I have other commitments going on. Where am I going to fit in time for me? Where am I going to fit in? Because it just feels like that's what's going to be too much. And yet that's the time you need to lean into that.
Absolutely.
All the more to be able to see the wood for the trees. Was there a breaking point or a rock bottom?
It was. It was just that pure exhaustion, like the pure exhaustion, mentally exhausted. And there is signs, like there's different signs where you're constantly tired. You know, even if you sleep well, you wake up tired and you're like, okay, you're emotionally numb. Sort of you start getting a bit narky, you know, to small things that didn't bother you. You know, someone saying something and you might go, that's not like me. And, you know, you're getting, because you're burnt out really. Your emotions are really burnt out. Yeah, you get headaches. Maybe your self-care might slip a little bit where you were at nighttime, where you might stay up for that extra episode where you should be in bed because you're like, oh, it doesn't matter. You know, I'll stay up till whatever hour I'll finish off the series. And that's like, you know, you're not looking after yourself. Yeah, you're not looking after yourself. Yeah, and you get an extra glass of wine the odd night and, you know, and you're sort of just pushing it. And it gets, again, everything's fine in moderation. But I think when you're up late, not sleeping, sleep is huge. And if you don't get a good night's sleep, you can't function well. And that's why, you know, having to learn something. And again, your body keeps the score. I think if you don't take the break, your body will take the break for you, isn't it? Like, so yeah. You actually, and you see a lot of people when they go on holidays and then they get sick on holidays because they finally let their body rest. And then they go, yeah, I was sick on holidays. I wonder why. And you're like going, yeah, because you've never stopped.
Yeah, it's the first time you've allowed that chronic stress that's been rumbling away. And as you say, a glass of wine, binge watching a series is fine.
Perfect, yeah.
Every now and then. Yeah. But if that's what you're doing to fill yourself back up without
exactly
other things, well, then that's where the problems come.
Yeah.
So when did you discover breath work? Were you a little cynical to it at all? Because I want you to help people through this.
I think you get to a stage in life when you're really low and rock bottom and you don't know where to go, you'll try anything. You will absolutely try anything. And my sister's, she's a primary school teacher as well, and she trained in a yoga, so she's quite, I think she sent me a link. I think family start seeing, and I always say to people, like, reach out to someone, send them a link, send them a podcast, and that might spark off, you know, even if you're not telling them, are you burnt out? If you start to see signs, it's a nicer way to say, are you burnt out? Just send them a podcast. Listen to this is really good. I find meditation and mindfulness, people say, I don't know what that is. Like if someone says meditate, I'm like, I can't quiet my mind. I can't actually sit there and just say, just calm down. It doesn't work. But breath work is really different because you're guided and you're just listening to instructions. So you're not just sitting there and waiting for, like, you know, the om, and, you know, and it doesn't work for me. It doesn't work. But breath work did. So what you're doing is you're breathing into your, I suppose the way to explain it is if when you were young and you were told no and yes to different things and you put everything in the no box was bad. So if you were told, maybe me as a boy, stop crying. And the crying is the best thing ever. I'd tell everybody, cry if you can. Like, and we were told not to cry because boys, you know, boys don't cry. So you suppress that emotion. So you are told, if you were to cry, even remember at funerals, I was hiding my tears and, you know, so you're suppressing all that emotion, even good emotions. If someone says, stop being so loud, stop being so happy, stop dancing, stop, you know, all them words. As a child, you know, because you're born free. And of course, rules are important. But when we're told stop so many times, you do suppress it. And you have to put on a mask and become somebody else to people please, to, you know, to keep people happy. So conscious connected breathwork, what that does is you're just breathing into those emotions. And then you can bring up any emotions that feel ready to come up. And it's so powerful because it'll heal without knowing it. And it's not me doing the work, as in I'm only the guide. I'm only setting the, you know, the space, as people call it, the safe space for people to breathe. I've gone to therapists over the years and they are amazing. And I know some amazing therapists and they're a top down approach. So you're talking, your head down, while a breath work is a body up approach where you don't have to open your mouth. Well, bar breathing, you open your mouth, but you don't have to talk. So you just lie there, listen to instructions, and then your breath does the work. I know that sounds really airy-fairy, your breath does the work, but it does. It's the most powerful, without taking a tablet, medication, it's in you. You know, it's there. It's available for everybody. And I think I had a skeptic the other day. I'll tell you this story, if you don't mind. She came to one of my classes. She said she never felt anything like it in her life. And this is the part that really, really hit me. Like, she had lost her daughter at a baby, like after nine hours. And that her birthday was actually yesterday, 14 years old. And she connected with her daughter during the breathwork. Like, she had a connection, which is like, how do you explain that to somebody without going, how? You know, it's like, so she relaxed her mind and she allowed herself to grieve. She was in counselling for 2 years every week and never cried, never was able to grieve. And during that breathwork session, she started grieving, started crying, and then had a beautiful connection. She was at her grave and she felt, she never felt like she did at the grave after 14 years. She felt like, I presume, freer. And like, for me to even just to hold that for her, to do that is just, you know, I could finish up tomorrow and be happy, you know, that I've done that for one person. So that's how powerful it is.
Yeah, it's really incredible. And to give yourself that space, and obviously the deep breathing really calms your central nervous system, and you're just taking that space. I mean, I do think it's important to say this is complementary therapy. So it's alongside the talk therapy, it's alongside the medication, but it can be a very profound experience, as you have said. So you've gone the whole hog. You're now a facilitator. You trained, and that's what you do now. So look, we never reach a point of utopia where we're like, this is it, I'm done. Yeah. But do you feel very content in where you are now?
Yeah, do I feel definitely more content, because I feel I'm in a job I love. I'm helping people again. The connection to me is massive. I realise that I need to be connected to people. And that's one thing of the one solution to burnout is reconnect with somebody. Because when you're in a busy job and that and rat race and you're running, sometimes you lose connection with the people who brought you joy and happiness. Like,
so important. So where can people find you?
My Instagram is the Breathwork Project. And I know that there's a lot of skeptics out there going, sure, don't we breathe every day? And don't we? But if you actually consciously breathe, and I know, Claire, you do breathwork and you see the benefits of it as well. So like, it's, I think, why not try it? And it's so easy to do. The good thing is, like, you can actually do it at your desk. You can do it, you know, anywhere without people noticing. You know, there's so many little breathworks that you can actually do without making it like, oh, I'm actually, look at Claire, look at Niall doing the breathwork over there. You don't have, no one knows. You're actually just doing it calmly, and all of a sudden you're, and it's, I'd love to get this into schools. Coming from education, I could think, like, I'm 46. Like, if I was 16, doing breath work or able to know what breath, or even playing football, calming myself before a big game, you know, where, you know, if people just knew how to do it. And there's such easy methods. That's something, you know, I think it should be brought in at an early as possible.
And it is something you will feel the benefit of instantly. Niall McHugo, thank you so much for coming on.
Thanks so much, Claire.
Now, Niall, you're going to lead us in a short breath work session. Tell us a little bit about which breath you've chosen.
The box breath is a really easy one. Once you have a screen in front of you, or a window, or a desk, something that's sort of rectangular or square. So this one is like it's a 4 second inhale through the nose, a 4 second hold, a 4 second exhale through the mouth, and a 4 second hold. But you can actually do it even on a book or a page and just time yourself by going round. You know, I always find a visual is nice because you're actually sort of following it around. And the Navy SEALs use that one to calm themselves before. So it's like, if they use it, it's definitely effective.
Yeah, but it's a good one if you can't sleep as well, I always find.
Yeah, it's just, and it's really simple, isn't it? Because it's four, so you can't make the mistake on that. But the one I've been using a lot lately is the extended exhale. And it's a 4 second, similar to that, 4 second in with the nose, a 4 second hold, but just extend the exhale. So like, even can do like 8 sometimes can be a long exhale, but if you can get as close to 8, so it's like a 4 second in, 4 second hold, and then a long exhale through the mouth. Like, sort of, you can do sort of like a whistle out through the mouth. And I find that really calms you down. What it does is the exhale activates the parasympathetic nervous system, which means it's relaxation.
Well, let's do rounds now, okay. Shall we?
Yeah. So again, you just get comfortable where you are. Again, if you're a place, you can close your eyes for this one. But if you're driving, obviously, you don't close your eyes. So we're going to take an inhale through the nose for 4 seconds. We're going to hold for 4, and then we're going to go out for 8. So I'll count it in. So in through the nose for 4. Hold for 4. And blow out through the mouth for 8. Okay, back in for 4 through the nose. Hold for 4. And then just blow out for 8. So if you do that, like maybe 4 times, 3, 4 times, you'll even feel your heart rate slow, your mind clear. And then, like I said, if you're ready to do a conscious connected breath work, you know, there's so many amazing facilitators around Ireland.
Thank you so much, Niall McHugo.
Thanks, Claire. Appreciate it. Thank you.
Alive and kicking on News Talk.
Now, Nadia Power is an Irish Olympian specialising in the 800 metres. She represented Ireland at the Tokyo 2021 Olympics and has competed at multiple international championships for Ireland. Nadia is also the co-founder of Irish sports accessories brand Swifter and creator of the Pursuit Training Journal, designed to help athletes stay motivated and structured in their training. And Nadia joins me on the line now. Nadia, you're very welcome.
Thanks for having me.
So Nadia, tell me your story when it comes to running. When did it become a big part of your life? Were you always involved at school level?
Yeah, sports always been huge for me, and it was actually driven by my mom. She's the one in our household who's really into sports. So I played camogie until I was 16, and then I did running as well all that time. And then I guess once I started to get opportunities to run internationally and stuff, I decided there was kind of more you could do with running, so I just decided to focus on that from around age 16, and yeah, I've been doing it ever since, and I guess never really thought too much about where I'd end up, just kept going and stuck at it because I really liked it.
And when it gets to competitive level, can you still maintain your love for it?
I think it's hard sometimes. It can be really dependent on how it goes. When you're facing injury, you don't love it, but then I think, you know, on those good days it makes everything worthwhile, or if you run a PB or make a team, that those days make it worthwhile. So there's definitely some addictive factor there that I think even more people around at all levels are discovering now to running.
Because there's a difference, isn't there, between just being able to head out for a run at the end of a day and doing it with competition looming. But then I suppose you get a team of experts helping you, and it's just something different, isn't it? It's not a better or worse, it's just different.
Yeah, it's a different way of looking at things. And look, I often envy people who can just enjoy it a little bit more without the pressure of trying to compete and managing competition and mindset and all that. But at the same time, I'm sure many people who just run day to day would love to be in my position and have ran at some of the races I've ran at. So yeah, I guess there's a trade-off there for sure.
And you're just back from a bit of a bucket list trip to Australia. Tell us a little bit about what you were up to there.
Yeah, I've always wanted a race in Australia for a season. So I have a lot of friends there right now, as a lot of people in their 20s do. So I visited in October and I found myself some training partners there, and I decided now is the perfect time to go back and do a season there, and then also work remotely because I'm self-employed now with our business. So it was a great time to kind of do some market research over there as well and get involved a little bit there too. But it was amazing to be kind of immersed in that culture, and I've noticed that all my friends who moved over have gotten even more into health and fitness since getting there.
Tell us a little bit about your business. Sounds like you definitely want to be getting your accessories into the Australian market if you can't get a spot on the path for the runners.
Yeah, for sure. So we started Swifter, myself and my partner James, who is also really involved in sport. He's on the Dublin hurling team. So we saw kind of a gap in sports accessories in 2023. So we started selling a running vest just kind of as an extra thing. We believe we can make a better product and kind of create better marketing assets and pictures for it, as well as what we saw in the market on Amazon. So we started selling that in June 2023, I think it was. And then we still were doing other things, and I had some other part-time work and he was working full-time. And then kind of last January, February, we both went a lot more full-time at it, and kind of we've made a website and started targeting retail now, and I'm just trying to build the brand and do a lot of events and get the awareness out now. But it's went really well for our first year or so.
And obviously it's going to feature in what you're doing at Wellfest. You're going to be running its first ever run club.
Yeah, so I think it's perfect timing for something like that. Obviously Wellfest has been going on for years, and getting so many people exercising in different forms and different types of classes and trying something new. So on the Sunday morning of Wellfest at 8:30, myself and Aveen Raleigh are starting leading a run just outside of the grounds. just a 5K social run, and then hoping kind of that's the perfect start for people to then go into the festival and enjoy it for the day.
What would you say to people who might be intimidated to run with an Olympian who think that you're just going to leave them for dust?
I think, Aveen's the perfect person there as well. I guess she's really kind of encouraged that social side of running and encouraging all paces. But whenever I host a run club with Swifter or myself, like, it's definitely not a race. We don't even really assign a pace at the start or target anything. We don't want people to be out of breath after. It's really just a social experience and making sure everyone runs together. I'm definitely not trying to run at a specific pace or anything. I just want to chat to as many people as possible and for as many people to feel included and kind of discover running.
That's really something that's grown over the last while, hasn't it? The social aspect and connection that comes with the community of running clubs. I mean, I've even heard anecdotally that they have become like the new dating apps, that people are, you know, stepping away from them and thinking, well, why don't I just go and meet like-minded people that like getting up on a Saturday or Sunday morning and going for a run? And there's kind of friendships blossoming, romance blossoming, and, you know, circle of friends growing.
Yeah, no, and it's really good. And to be honest, sometimes I do envy kind of people, I guess, enjoying that side of social, that social side of running that I kind of often have to miss maybe with my own training. But no, it's such a good way to meet people. I think we're all on our phones all the time, maybe on dating apps or just scrolling the whole time, and it can actually be really hard to meet people in your 20s, because people tend to have established friend groups and you know, kind of not step out of them too much. So activities like run clubs are a perfect way to meet new people and who have a similar routine to you. So no, it's incredible. And it's incredible that there's kind of one nearly in every area now, so everyone can get involved.
I mentioned your journal earlier. Is that something you use to help with your motivation and structure? Do you have any other tips for people?
Yeah, so I've kept a journal for the last 10 years. So I have all my training for 10 years, pretty much every distance I've ran, every day, every, you know, time, each rep took. And that was a tip I got from Sonia O'Sullivan. She actually gifted me one of my first training journals about 10 years ago, and I've kept that habit since. I think it's like a really popular habit for people who do athletics and maybe individual sports, but we created the journal because we saw more people taking, you know, their fitness seriously. And also we wanted to encourage them and I guess provide inspiration and also kind of say, look, it's okay. You don't have to be at like a really high level to keep a journal and motivate yourself, that anyone who has a different routines can do it. So it's just the idea of writing down your goals, because you're going to be more accountable to them then when you have them written down on paper, even more so than having it, I guess, written on an app or on your phone. There's something like extra that triggers in your brain when you actually write them down. So I always go back to that.
So with everything that you've said, training at elite level, do you still think you have balance in your life? Do you still have focus on that?
Yeah, I think I do have balance, but that's because I am self-employed now at the moment. I guess my journey in kind of being self-employed has been inspired by me not being able to find a situation with employment for myself that worked, really, to be honest, that kind of allowed me to go on training camp when I need to go on or compete on certain days, if a race is on a Wednesday night in a random country. I struggled for a few years trying to find that right employment setup. I've kind of like experimented with a lot of things and found myself here now, kind of accidentally, but just working in my own time helps me. I can go and train whenever I want, so I usually will prioritize that before you know, getting to work. It's definitely busy, but I find it's the best way to keep like my mind healthy. Having something else has really helped me when I've been injured over the last few years and had faced some hard times and been disappointed with where athletics is. Like, having something else I feel passionate about has been hugely helpful. And I'm like hoping, you know, when I can turn things around a little bit and get a good streak injury free, that I can then step away a little bit from work, maybe if I need to, and focus more on that.
Well, certainly somebody who specialises in the 800 metres is not supposed to sit still. If people want to find out more, you can go to Nadia's Instagram at NadiaPower_. You'll also find out more at GetSwifter. And Wellfest is on at Kilmainham in Dublin, May 10th and 11th. For more info and tickets, go to wellfest.ie. Nadia, I hope we get to meet face to face at the festival, and I wish you all the very best. Thank you so much for coming on.
Yeah, I would love to. Thank you so much.
Alive and Kicking. on News Talk.
Now, Dr. Conor Curley is a doctor of nutrition, an award-winning nutrition researcher and a leading dietitian. And he joins me in studio now to tell the story of what led to his career path. Conor, you're very welcome.
Good morning, Claire. Thanks a million for having me.
A lot of work has gone into that introduction, hasn't it? A lot of academic work and research.
Absolutely, yeah. So I did my undergraduate in Trinity, which is 4.5 years. And then I worked for about a year. And then I did my clinical doctorate with the School of Medicine, which took another 4 years. So kind of 8.5 years. But I'm a lifelong learner.
Yeah, I mean, I make it sound in a few sentences like it was a hop, skip and a jump. But I'm sure there was blood, sweat and tears. But you do love what you do, and you were very motivated by your own health journey. You were diagnosed in your teens with MS.
I was, yeah. So I remember well, I was a keen basketball player, and just after Christmas, I had a dead leg, or what I thought was a dead leg. And it got worse and worse to the point where I couldn't really walk. And I was quite a fit young 15-year-old, and I ended up in a brain scanner at midnight on New Year's Eve in 2002. And fast forward 8 months, lots of tests, lots of scans and lots of time spent in hospitals, lots of school missed. I was eventually diagnosed with MS in August 2003.
That must have been a real blow. Any kind of diagnosis that you think may limit you in any way, shape or form is difficult. But when did you begin to make the link between nutrition and our health and how this might impact you?
I suppose like as a young 15-year-old, and this was back in just 2002, so I'm showing my age now, but I mean, there was no Facebook. We didn't have a computer in our home, you know, so it was very difficult to access information, but there still was misinformation. So I got a lot of my information from the local library, and unfortunately I didn't really know what to look for. But I suppose I was always keenly aware of nutrition and how important it was, but more from a sports angle, a performance angle than a health angle. And then things switched very, very quickly. And then I decided that, you know, this was really important, and I decided to put down on my CAO form, number one, nutrition and dietetics. So,
because you're here and we're talking about it, what is MS?
So MS, multiple sclerosis, is characterised as an autoimmune disorder where your body attacks the myelin, which is in your brain and spinal cord. It's an autoimmune disease, which means your own body attacks itself, the immune system attacks itself. And it's kind of characterised by systemic inflammation or inflammation over the entire body. And depending on whereabouts in the spine or brain these lesions or these attacks occur will dictate the symptoms. But the symptoms can really be anything. Fatigue being really common, I was certainly very fatigued. And also I lost complete power and function of my entire left-hand side. So I had to learn how to walk and talk again. And, you know, it can affect nearly anything and anybody at any one time. But common issues would be fatigue, balance issues, issues with muscle, mood, things like that.
And we met recently at an event, and I said, are you going to tell your story? And I meant the story of your brand. Yeah. And you said, do you mean my story with MS? And I was really thrown, because I think when we hear MS or multiple sclerosis, we think on sight we're going to see that somebody perhaps has a diagnosis, but you wouldn't know with you at all. Is that work that you've done? Are you particularly lucky? Is it a silent sort of condition?
Well, as I say, it can be silent, but for me, it certainly was not. So I had 3 major attacks within 8 months, which led to my diagnosis. As I say, I had to learn how to walk again, how to talk, how to tie my shoelaces, how to hold a knife and fork. I spent some time in a wheelchair. So I guess like MS, it can really affect everybody differently, and someone may not look disabled but may have severe fatigue issues or severe mood issues. And thankfully I'm relatively symptom free and medication free over 22 years after diagnosis now. So I think lifestyle is really important, and I think science has shown that, but more and more we see neurologists and physicians becoming interested in the power of lifestyle, which isn't just nutrition, which is my focus, but also exercise, stress reduction, you know, sleeping well. It's kind of everything within your daily life, your lifestyle.
And we do have a massive increase in autoimmune conditions, don't we? And many of them don't have the name MS, but people are finding that inflammation in their body is causing it to function in a different way to how it should. Do we know why that is?
Well, it probably, because we're seeing this increase, it probably suggests that the environment is important as opposed to genes, which don't change, you know, within years. It takes thousands of years for genes to change. So absolutely, we know that we're all getting more stressed. We're all getting more busy. We know that kind of lifestyle factors are deteriorating where people aren't exercising well every day. We know we're not sleeping well. We know we're more stressed, and then we know we're not eating well. So we're kind of facing into this perfect storm of, you know, low grade inflammation all the time, which is going to cause increased autoimmune diseases on a population level. And that's exactly what we're seeing.
And you touched on the way we're eating and nutrition. And we're hearing a lot about it now, ultra processed foods, the importance of whole foods. And I think sometimes people think, you know, they get it, but it's very hard to bring it into their every day. But how powerful is nutrition in how we live?
Yeah, I think it's really, really powerful. And I guess, like, it's not a quick fix. You can't eat a salad and expect to be cured. Similarly, you know, having one Big Mac is not going to cause you to have cancer or heart disease. But eating well or better, let's say, consistently is absolutely a really good idea for anybody, no matter their age or they have to have, if they have a condition or not. So, I mean, there's some phenomenal research showing that nutrition can reduce risk of diseases and sometimes even reverse some damage caused by diseases. And, you know, it's something that everybody has the power to do. Whereas, you know, for example, you know, a surgery, like I can't do a surgery on myself, but I know I can eat healthy foods. And what I would say to anybody who's listening who maybe knows that their diet isn't optimal, like, it's not easy to change your diet, but just start off small and add things in as opposed to removing things. So don't worry about, you know, removing all the bad things immediately, but just maybe adding some more fruits and vegetables. And that's really a very simple place to start, and pick what you like and just add those in and, you know, build from there.
When did you begin to get interested in reproductive health and fertility and the link with nutrition there?
Yeah, so very briefly, back in 2019, I was asked to speak at the Endometriosis Association of Ireland conference. And at the time, I said yes. I was speaking at a lot of conferences. But as soon as I got off the phone, I had to Google, what is endometriosis? I'd never even heard of it. So I did my preparation, I went along and I spoke there, and then I came to realise that endometriosis is a major cause of fertility issues in females. And last year I went to an exhibition called the Future Fertility Show, and I just saw how severe of an issue fertility is in Ireland and really globally. And this has been compounded by my wife, who gave birth to our lovely son, Caelan, 8 months ago. And thankfully, we didn't have any fertility issues, but we've come to learn that a lot of our friends did. And that's really not unusual. It's roughly 1 in 6 couples globally have a fertility issue. And it makes sense that nutrition would be involved in everything in life, including fertility. And in fact, the science absolutely supports that.
I remember when we were trying for our now 2 kids and it wasn't happening. I was pulling all kinds of things. I remember having my husband drink caffeine-free tea and all sorts, because this was whatever book I had at the time was telling me. Is there a diet for optimum fertility?
Well, there's no, like, kind of named single diet as such, but we know that there are some foods which promote healthy fertility in men and women, and some foods which maybe aren't so beneficial. And the foods which maybe aren't so beneficial are high in saturated fats and high in inflammatory ingredients like trans fats as well. So saturated fats would be fats that are hard at room temperature. So think of butter, think of cheese, think of the fat on a pork chop, for example, whereas olive oil is liquid at room temperature. Vice versa, we know that fats which are unsaturated, like your nuts, seeds, avocado and your olive oil, are actually beneficial for fertility in men and women. And then colourful fruits and vegetables combat something called oxidative stress, which is definitely involved in fertility issues in men and women. So that's a really good place to start for fertility.
What is oxidative stress?
So the easy way to think about it, and I always describe it to my patients, is, you know, if you have an apple and you take a bite of the apple, after a few minutes, the apple starts to go brown. That's the oxygen damaging the apple. And the same thing happens inside the human body. There's only 2 ways to stop this damage. By the way, oxidative stress is completely natural and normal, but excess is bad. And this is what happens now. And things which can increase oxidative stress are pollution, stress, cigarette smoking, fast food, burnt food, etc., etc. All the things we're exposed to a lot. So oxidative distress has been linked to lots of different things, from MS to fertility to cardiovascular disease to cancers and so on. So we can combat it, number one, by not breathing oxygen, which isn't really practical. But number two is consuming a diet rich in antioxidants, which will be your colourful fruits and vegetables, your nuts and seeds. But the superstars of antioxidants are herbs and spices.
Wow. And it's just adding things in. That's what I always think. More colour on the plate, more herbs and spices in your cooking. How many things can you get on the one plate, exactly, rather than that focus on what are you taking out, what can you not have?
And people tend to think of eating healthy means removing the foods we love, which are maybe high in fat and sugar and salt. And when if you actually add in the foods that you like that are really healthy, that's probably going to be more sustainable and just as healthy. There's some fascinating research showing that a really unhealthy meal can actually paralyze your arteries within hours. But if you have that exact same unhealthy meal with, for example, a portion of blueberries or a teaspoon of herbs and spices, your arteries don't really get affected at all. Now, I'm not advising people to run out to their nearest chipper and have a portion of blueberries with it every day, but it just shows the power of including, you know, a small amount of really healthy foods is really, really powerful.
And do you find, as an expert in nutrition working in this area, when you and your wife go to a friend's house for dinner, are they like, oh, don't look in my cupboards and don't look in my fridge? And yet that's not how normal people live. You know, we're allowed to have certain amounts of these foods.
Absolutely. So like some people do definitely think that I'm the food police, and I'm certainly not. definitely not. And, you know, I'm very practical. I talk about, you know, not about perfection, because we don't even know what dietary perfection is, but it's about like kind of progress and, you know, just doing a little bit better than, you know, than the average person who may not be doing so well. So like, have I had a biscuit in the past? Absolutely. And, you know, is someone a bad person or a really unhealthy person for having someone unhealthy? Not at all.
Yeah. And I think people can get kind of intimidated by that, or some of the environmental factors, like you said, like pollution, things we can't control. They think, oh, sure, I may as well throw my whole hat at it. But I think the example you gave of a small amount of blueberries alongside an unhealthy meal can make a big difference. It's quite empowering that we can make small changes that can make a big difference. Tell me a bit about setting up your company, Phytofix, because supplements can cause controversy, can't they? And did you in any way have any sort of hesitation? Because I assume you're food first. You don't want to say, here's a magic pill that's going to solve everything. What was your thought process in all of that?
Absolutely. So I guess, you know, after I completed my clinical doctorate with the School of Medicine at UCD, I then got headhunted for a role in Washington, and then I got funded to go to Australia to present my research over there. And while over there, I kind of had my epiphany moment, let's come back to Ireland and see if we can do something with this research. And the area we were initially interested in was cardiovascular disease, because I won a lot of awards for my research on blood pressure, which is a really important risk factor. So we were about to do a clinical trial, and then COVID-19 hit and my whole world collapsed, because I had no money, I had no job, I had no security, nobody was hiring. I'm sure everyone can remember.
You had all these qualifications.
And nothing to show for it. So we pivoted from cardiovascular focus towards an immune focus, because everybody was interested in immunity. But my real passion was helping people with, you know, health issues. So what we did next was we looked at some of the research which had been done, and we looked at some research which had been done in MS initially. And they saw that some nutrition compounds could actually get into the brain and have anti-inflammatory effects in people with MS and reduce the size of their lesions. And this was just remarkable. And I was thinking, my God, like, I want to take this. So I started looking into it, and then other people started contacting me and taking it. Now, that product's called NeuroFix. It's based on amazing research, and it's specifically to help the nervous system, to help with inflammation, and also to help with fatigue. We also then looked at some research on endometriosis, and similarly saw some nutrition compounds that had been studied and had some amazing effects. So then we come up with a product called Endohormone Fix, which again had been shown to be beneficial for hormone metabolism, for inflammation, and for oxidative stress, which we spoke about. And I guess it does come back to nutrition, but some of the components which had actually been studied in really good studies in humans, not in animals or in lab tests, are not really found in the diet. I'm talking about things like Indian frankincense. I'm talking about bromelain, which actually comes from pineapple, but you'd have to eat the equivalent of 21 pineapples to get the therapeutic dose. I'm talking about things like andrographolide, which comes from andrographis, which is a plant found in a herbal plant found in Sri Lanka. So again, many people won't have heard of these and certainly won't be in their diet, but they've already got scientifically documented benefits for specific conditions like endometriosis and MS.
And I said supplements can be controversial, but this is the important part. This is based on research, and that's where you need to be careful. You can't just pick up something off a supermarket shelf and think that's going to be your fix. There should be supplement certification, and you need to really make sure that you research what you're taking and what evidence base is behind that.
Absolutely. You know, like, supplements weren't so common, let's say 10 or 20 years ago, but there's a huge marketing drive on, and now it's more common for someone to take supplements than not take supplements in the Western world. But a lot of people are taking supplements which probably have little or no benefit and definitely have little or no science. So if you are interested, I would recommend asking for the evidence. If you're telling me this is good for hormonal health, what is the evidence? Like, show me the evidence and ask for that evidence. Do not be afraid of that.
And I love that you're working so much in the area of women's health, because we've been told for so long that women can't be studied in a clinical trial because of our hormone fluctuation, because of pregnancy risk, that if you were a part of a clinical trial and you became pregnant, there could be damage. But you're bucking that trend too, because you are researching these issues and helping make a difference.
Yeah, so at the minute I'm not involved directly in clinical research myself, but in the past I certainly was, and we always made sure to include men and women, which is really important because women are 50% of the population, right? So if we don't know if it works in women, then it becomes a little bit less useful. So absolutely, what you've said is true. Like, we do have to have a little bit more consciousness about, you know, pregnancy risk in a lady, and also how the lady cycle may affect the results of the study. So it makes it a little bit more complicated, but science is complicated, and we need to, as scientists, do better and say, look, we are consciously going to include at least 50% women in the study. If it's a general condition, and if it's a female condition, then it's going to be 100% female, and just take account of all these things like hormonal cycles and pregnancy and so on.
Well, I hope this comes across the right way, but I'm really proud of everything that, when I think back to 15-year-old Connor getting that diagnosis and everything that that has led to. Do you ever take stock and take that on?
I mean, life is busy, but, you know, recently I was just contacted a girl from my hometown, Dundalk, who's just turned 16, and she's just been diagnosed. And she was referred to me by a local physio who said, look, there's this guy, he had MS, he was diagnosed at 15, and he would be worth talking to. And I know that I've already just lifted her hopes and her spirit and helped her journey. And that's what wakes me up in the morning.
Yeah, that's magic. Connor, where can people find out more?
Yeah, so just Google my name. It's an unusual, so Connor and then Curly. It's a Dundalk surname, so K-E-R-L-E-Y. I'm here to help.
To find out more, you can go to Connor's Instagram page. He's at Dr_ConnorCurly. Connor, thank you very much again for coming on. So that's it for Live and Kicking for this week. My thanks to my producer, Marisa O'Sullivan, Rory Galvin, who was on podcasts, and Hugo De Silva Scott, who was on sound. And thanks to you for listening. I will see you next week.
Alive and Kicking with Claire McKenna. Sunday morning at 8 on News Talk.
The new McCrispy strip is here. Dip approved by ketchup, tangy barbecue, honey mustard, Sprite, McFlurry, Big Mac sauce, double dipped in buffalo and ranch, more ranch, and creamy chili McCrispy strip dip. Now at McDonald's. Ba-da-ba-ba-ba.